The government can literally track you. Maybe they find out that you're not working hard enough. Maybe you're talking bad about the government, etc. And they can say, okay, this guy doesn't fit in our thing. Let's just give him a higher inflation rate.
This is the Bitcoin Infinity Podcast,
a show where we take you through the Bitcoin rabbit hole and beyond.
Hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to another episode of Bitcoin Infinity Podcast. My name is Ram.
And I'm Krishna.
So in the last episode, we covered how Bitcoin is better than gold in many ways. And we think it'll be good to cover some basic fundamentals of Bitcoin, clear some terminologies out of the way, so that it'll be helpful in understanding how Bitcoin matters. So let's dive right in. Krishna is planning to give a dramatic entry to Bitcoin.
As the 2008 financial crisis was beginning to take world stage, with governments deploying massive bailouts to financial institutions, at one corner in the internet, a mysterious white paper showed up. And all it said was, Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system.
I think that's enough for a dramatic intro. Basically, this white paper emerged on October 31st, 2008. Just after the financial crash, like Krishna mentioned. This white paper was authored by this anonymous person called Satoshi Nakamoto, wherein he, she, or they propose a system of money that behaves like electronic cash, but it's going to be decentralized. And it also introduced something called digital scarcity. And most importantly, it solved the problem of double spending. Just to rewind a little bit, a lot of cryptographers since 1980s have worked on a concept of digital cash, but it sort of never worked because, like we explained, anything in the digital realm, it's just information, and information can be copied because it's just bytes. A lot of these solutions, either they had severe flaws or it had the problem of centralization. Bitcoin was the first to crack this problem of double spending.
So in order to explain double spending, let me start with a quick example. Let's say I have $10 in cash and I want to give that to Ram. So once I give that $10 to Ram, I don't hold that cash anymore, right? So there is no way that I can give $10 to Ram and give the same $10 to another friend of mine. So it's very easy in the physical system because there's no double spending. If I have $10, I can use it only once. Let's now go to the digital space.
Yeah, let's say I take a photo of the $10 note. I have the image of $10. Let's say people believe that this is money and I take this $10 digital item and I'm going to use it to pay Krishna this time. He's happy because he got the $10 digital item. But what I can do is I can actually copy it and I can spend it somewhere else. So this was the problem with digital cash all throughout.
So if you look at even the banking system that we use right now, so that's also a form of digital money, right? Because, you know, you log in, you find your bank balance, and let's say I want to give that to Ram. So let me do the same thing. Let me just send $10 to Ram from my bank account to his bank account online, right? So that's digital money. But in this case, let's say as soon as I send the $10, the bank is going to have its ledger or the balance sheet, whatever you call it. And it's going to say, Krishna now has $10 less, Ram now has $10 more. So again, here I cannot spend the $10 twice because there is a central entity.
Exactly.
Which is logging in how much money that I spend. So there is no way I can use the $10 twice. I cannot send it to Ram and at the same time send it to another friend.
So yeah, in the digital realm, like so far, nobody had solved the problem of double spending. Like you always needed a central entity to maintain a ledger and to keep track of how much money each person had and how much each person owed. So Bitcoin truly solved this in a decentralized manner for the very first time, and it blew everyone's mind. And a lot of these cryptographers were skeptical, but it drew the attention of very few cryptographers, commonly known as cypherpunks. And around January 3rd, 2009, Satoshi said, hey, I'm ready with my Bitcoin software. Basically, Satoshi gave 2 months notice for everyone to go through the paper. And on January 3rd, Satoshi started running Bitcoin. Okay, you might say, enough with the history. Just explain to me Bitcoin like I'm 5. Let's take an example, shall we?
Sure. So let's say four of us here, we are playing a game of Monopoly. So we don't usually have a banker, right? Like, you know, when four of us are playing and let's say I land at, say, Ram's property and I have to pay him rent. I just say it's $100. I just give him 100 and I say, hey, everyone, see, I've given Ram $100. What do all of us do? We just go back to our note and say, Krishna paid Ram $100 and that's it. There is no banker here. Nobody, no one person takes note of all of this. This notebook is typically called a ledger. And in the Bitcoin network, such a ledger is actually called a blockchain.
Why blockchain? Basically, it's nothing but a chain of blocks, honestly. All these transactions, it goes into something called a block. And a block is sealed like after 10 minutes or so. And the next set of transactions is added in the next block. And it has reference to the previous block. So we have like a chain of blocks starting from 2008, if you see. So how is a block sealed? So basically, that's where a miner comes into play. What a miner, the role of a miner is they basically seal the block or the set of transactions. And that way, you know, your transaction has happened. Why would a miner do that? Basically, the miner will get something called a transaction fee. So when I go to a coffee shop, I pay someone in Bitcoin. That Bitcoin transaction gets sealed by the work of a miner. And I give my transaction, in my transaction, I give a transaction fee to the miner. On top of this, a miner gets something called a block reward. So when the miner actually seals the transaction, the network actually rewards the miner with newly minted Bitcoins. That's how Bitcoins as we know it so far, 18 million or whatever that's out so far, is through the mining process.
So you may think that anyone can become a miner, right? But the network wants you to spend energy in the real world in order to mine in the Bitcoin network. So which means this is similar to gold in that aspect that in gold mining, you need to do physical work in order to dig up the gold. And then in order to process the gold, you also have to go through a lot of energy intensive processes. So in that sense, Bitcoin mining is similar but more straightforward, where you just use up energy in the real world. And that's why, you know, the term mining even originated in Bitcoin, because they were just trying to say this is similar to gold mining. In Bitcoin network or in the Bitcoin space, this is why it's called the proof of work.
So yeah, just to recap so far, I go to a shop, I pay the shopkeeper in Bitcoin. What my Bitcoin software will do is it will broadcast the transaction. And the miner who is listening to all the transaction is going to take these transactions, put it in a block, perform the proof of work, and will seal the block. And the miner gets rewarded with newly minted Bitcoins. So you may think mining might be very profitable and you can bring a lot of miners in to start mining. But the way the protocol is defined, like this is actually the one of the best features of Bitcoin. It has something called a difficulty adjustment. So how it works is if you bring a lot of miners in and if you have a lot of miners in the network who are processing the transactions, the protocol will adjust the complexity of the problem, of the proof of work problem that Krishna explained, in such a way that miners are able to mine the blocks only approximately every 10 minutes. So let's take an example. Let's say more miners join the network. Transactions that's happening every 10 minutes might start happening every 8 minutes or so. So what the protocol might see is, okay, there are more miners, transactions are happening faster. So let's adjust the difficulty, which is the complexity of the proof of work problem, such that the miners are able to solve every approximately 10 minutes. And conversely, let's say if miners choose to drop out of the network, and if transactions are happening for, let's say, every 15 minutes or 20 minutes, protocol will lower the difficulty such that, again, the transactions are happening every 10 minutes or so. And we actually witnessed this very recently. China banned all of its miners out of the country. So miners started dropping out of the network and the protocol started seeing the difficulty being high for the remaining set of miners. It started lowering the difficulty and eventually blocks started mining every 10 minutes.
So just to clarify the proof of work problem, it's not a complex mathematical puzzle or something, but it's a simple brute force guessing game, or like, you know, guessing just a number. And that's what the miners do. They just guess a number among a huge sample space of numbers. The sample space is so huge. So it's a number which is 2 to the power of 256. It's kind of not easily comprehensible, but the number is so big that it's actually greater than the number of atoms in the universe. So that's how big a number 2 to the power of 256 is. And every miner sits down, guesses one number at a time. Of course, you know, the miner itself is a hardware that does it. It guesses one number at a time, and then the miner has to be lucky enough to get the particular number among the huge sample space of numbers. So that's why the proof of work algorithm is very, very energy intensive.
And one another beauty of the proof of work, or rather the cryptographic algorithm, is even though it is energy intensive to secure the block, secure the transaction, it is actually very, very easy to verify. This is where I'd like to bring in nodes. So nodes are just participants in the network who just verify the transactions that the miners are putting into the blockchain. So what do the nodes have? Nodes basically, anyone can run a node, in the sense, like, if you have a $50 Raspberry Pi, you can run a node. All it does is it has the Bitcoin software running, and it has the entire copy of the blockchain, starting from 2009 with Satoshi's first block to all the transactions that's happened right now. And what the node does is, when a miner seals a block, it verifies if this is a valid block. And like I said, the verification process is very quick.
Let's take an example of someone solving a Sudoku puzzle, right? It takes somewhere between an hour to a couple of hours to solve a Sudoku puzzle, based on, you know, how difficult the puzzle is.
But yeah, it literally takes like 1 minute to verify if you've solved it or not. So it's very similar to that. Like, proof of work algorithm might take 10 minutes to solve the cryptographic problem, but it literally takes a matter of I don't know how much seconds my nodes take, but yeah, it takes a matter of seconds for the nodes to actually verify if the block that the miner has sealed is valid or not.
So that's why running a node hardly consumes any energy. And it's important that more people run the node, because nodes verify the transactions that the miners secure, and that makes the network more decentralized. So going back to our monopoly example, as I was giving the $100 to Ram, it's important the other two players who are playing the game go back to their ledger or their notebook and write down that this transaction actually happened. Because in this example, they are the nodes, and it's important that they write this transaction down, because that makes the system more decentralized.
Yeah, and just to recap, the miners secure the network and the nodes make the network more decentralized. And one last important piece to the Bitcoin protocol is the halving mechanism. If you remember, the miner, after sealing a block into the blockchain, they get rewarded newly minted Bitcoins called as block reward or block subsidy. What happens in the protocol is, approximately every 4 years or every 210,000 blocks, the block subsidy gets halved. It started with,
I think in 2008, when Satoshi started the first block, the block reward was 50 per block. Yeah, so it started with 50 per block. In 2012, it became 25 Bitcoins as a reward per block, and then it became 12.5 in 2016. And in 2020, and at this point, it stands at 6.25 Bitcoins per block. So putting it in a bigger perspective, in 2008, every day we used to get a supply of 7,200 Bitcoins. And now we stand at 900 Bitcoin as the incoming supply per day.
Yeah, and one other thing to compare with the current day monetary system is, like, we see quantitative easing these days. This is literally the opposite. This is like quantitative tightening, wherein the supply gets halved, and then the supply is tightened every 4 years and eventually reaches at a 0% terminal inflation rate at year around 2140. And one other beauty of the halving is, if you look at it from a game theoretic aspect, the difficulty adjustment makes the miner like marginal producers. Basically, they are forced to sell most of their Bitcoins to cover the operational and electricity costs. and which means the miners are constantly providing a downward selling pressure to the Bitcoin. And once the halving happens, so basically the miners are getting half as many Bitcoins the next block. So now, assuming the demand is the same, the price needs to go up. So it actually, if you look at it from a game theory aspect, it actually disrupts the equilibrium between the supply and demand. And I think halving is interesting from that aspect.
Another aspect which makes halving really interesting is from the Moore's law point of view.
Yeah, it fits right well.
Exactly. So because every 2 years, according to Moore's law, every 2 years, the computational power doubles, which means that it becomes easier for me to mine Bitcoins 4 years from now. So if there was no halving, I would have all the incentive to not mine today, but rather mine 4 years from now. So that's another thing that halving takes care of, because 4 years from now, the technology is going to be much better. The computational speed is going to be much greater. So it's imperative that I should be getting less Bitcoins because I'm doing less computationally intensive work.
Yeah. And if you notice, halving is the reason why we have the 4 year Bitcoin cycle, the bear and the bull market. But that's a topic for another episode.
Speaking about prices, for 2 years, starting from 2008 till 2010, people were mining Bitcoin. People are running nodes, but there was no price associated with Bitcoin in the free market. But something strange happened in 2010. Florida man on an online forum, he said he was ready to pay 10,000 bitcoins for 2 Papa John's pizza. He was asking if anyone was ready to deliver that to him. It so happened that he eventually sealed the deal. At that time, those 2 pizzas were worth around $41. That puts the price of 1 Bitcoin around 0.4 cents. So looking at it after 11 years, look at the price of Bitcoin right now,
10,000 Bitcoins, that's like $500 million for those 2 pizzas.
That's one of the most expensive pizzas anyone could have ever had.
So we've covered all the Bitcoin fundamental features, but one thing we really want to cover is the importance of decentralization and why Bitcoin matters as a result. So we are moving to a cashless society. That is very, very evident. So we have Visa right now. If I go to a coffee shop, I can swipe my Visa, and Visa is very efficient. They process around 25,000 transactions per second compared to Bitcoin 7 transactions per second. So, but there is one problem, right? Like, it is a central entity that you are putting your trust in. And with that trust, like, it comes enormous power. Like Visa, it need not be Visa, but any central entity, we've seen this so far, they have the power to refuse you to perform the transaction. They have the power to refuse you to create an account. They have the power to refuse you to participate in this economic activity at all. They have the power to demand your records and pull your credit worthiness, and they have the power to even ask you for your identity. And it's simply not peer-to-peer. Like, I pay the coffee shop guy, it doesn't go to the coffee shop keeper immediately. What happens is Visa processes it and it goes to another corporation, and the other corporation may choose to pay the shopkeeper based on certain rules and regulations. So the end result is, because of all this centralization, is like 75% of the people have no bank accounts.
And also another problem with such a banking system is that it works only 9 to 5, right? Let's say you go to a bank, you say you reach there at 6 o'clock, and they say you want to transfer money. They're going to say, just come back tomorrow. We work only 9 to 5, and they don't work on weekends. So which means you can't transfer money during the weekends. Let's say that eventually your bank is okay to transfer money, and then you say, okay, can you transfer $30,000? And they're going to say, no, we have limits. We don't transfer so much money. So because of this centralized nature, it puts so much limitations on even the people who are banked. And of course, because of all the things that Ram explained, we have more than 75% of the people who are unbanked.
And like, I've literally witnessed this like a couple of weeks back. Like, my friend, she tried to set up a PayPal account. She got her first payment on her PayPal account. She got like $120, and PayPal flagged it. saying, hey, there's a spike in unusual spike apparently in the account, and that's literally been the first transaction, and the account is still frozen to date for the last 6 months or so. So all these central entities, they have the power to even hold your money.
Yeah,
take as much time as they want, and they don't need to answer, and you're at the receiving end.
Bitcoin, for the first time, allows us to use digital money without involving any corporation, without an intermediary that have the power over us to deny or, you know, ask for an ID card or ask for a credit score. And Bitcoin, for the first time, enables the unbanked to be banked.
And if you understand, like, it's not just a technological breakthrough. It's not like an innovative Square or new PayPal. It's a monetary breakthrough, just like the internet, right?
Yeah, just like the internet. So if you think about the internet, all you need is a physical device or a physical means in order to access the internet. And once you are in there, internet doesn't care. Internet doesn't care what religion you are, what caste you are. The flow of information is available to all. So Bitcoin is just doing the exact same thing to the flow of value. So internet enabled the flow of information, boundaryless, borderless, and that's what exactly Bitcoin is doing to money or value.
And at the same time, like, the power of decentralization sort of unlocked Bitcoin to be like censorship resistant, seizure resistant, like Krishna said, borderless, it's permissionless, it's programmable, and it's truly peer-to-peer.
And speaking of seizure, in 1933, Franklin Roosevelt was the president back then. He ordered a seizure of the gold held by all the citizens. So basically, all the citizens of the US had to give up their gold. If they don't give it up, it will be confiscated from them by force. So people literally lost all the gold that they had. And the government said, we will pay you only $20 for that gold. It doesn't matter what the free market value of gold was.
And yeah, and good luck trying to seize my bitcoins, like, and good luck trying to guess my private keys. It's like, all you need to store your bitcoins is you just need the seed phrase, which is basically the 24 words. And all you need is to memorize these 24 words, and good luck trying to get that out of my brain. So Bitcoin is truly seizure resistant. And the most important thing is Bitcoin is truly immutable, and I don't have to worry about a central entity modifying the supply. For example, if I own one Bitcoin, I know there will only be 21 million Bitcoins in the future. I know I will own 1/21,000,000th of the value in the network. So I don't have to worry that my money will be devalued either through supply inflation
or through demonetization, like how we saw this example in India, where the government decided overnight that 500 rupee notes and 1000 rupee notes have like no value. So it literally gave like a 4-hour window and said after that window, all those 500 rupee notes and 1000 rupee notes will have no value. But of course, it didn't end there, and there was corruption, which meant that even after the 4-hour window, people who had power, people who had power could actually exchange their 500 rupee and 1000 rupee note. So all these problems actually come up purely because of a centralized entity.
Yeah, and they do it in the name of like fighting corruption or nationalism. And at the end of the day, it's our money that's getting devalued. So Bitcoin truly fixes this. And before we close, like I really want to touch upon one topic, that is financial privacy and surveillance. And we are moving towards a more cashless society. All governments, they're planning to bring in this central bank digital currency, in short CBDC. For sure, I can assure you that this is not for ease of use. This is mainly for surveillance. Let's take an example of China, right? Like WeChat is an app, it's a super app where you can use it to chat with your loved ones. You can order groceries, you can order a cab. You can even pay your electricity bills. You can pay your phone bills. But this app is a honeypot for all the data. And the Chinese government actually performs surveillance on all the activity that's happening on WeChat. As a result, what's happening is the people in China literally don't have any financial privacy. And if you perform any wrongdoing, if you perform any illicit transaction, it will affect your credit score. They have like a social credit score system, and it's a dystopian future, right? Like
in China, basically, if you utter even a single wrong word about the president or the ruling communist party, they'll literally just freeze your bank accounts. You just cannot make any transfer. And it's not just China, right? I mean, in Russia and Belarus, if you paid donations or if you send donations to human rights activist movements, your bank accounts will again be freezed. So it's literally happening in almost a lot of countries.
And yeah, like 53%, which is like 4.2 billion of the world's population, live under authoritarian government. And they all experience it day in, day out. And people in the remaining privileged countries, they think this cannot happen to them, but with the emergence of CBDC, things can get bad all of a sudden. With just all it needs is like one bad leader, and things can go wrong.
Yeah, that's totally right. Right, I mean, we can potentially have a future where, with so much surveillance, with all the CBDCs, like Ram mentioned, the government can literally track you, totally your credit score, your activities, and maybe they find out that you're not working hard enough, maybe you're talking bad about the government, etc. And they can say, okay, this guy doesn't fit in our thing. Let's just give him a higher inflation rate than maybe a normal person. So potentially we could have every person with a different inflation rate based on their credit score. And just imagine such a future.
It's chilling. Yeah. Another example is like, let's say I keep buying video games as an adult, and then governments suddenly think, okay, this guy is not that responsible, let's raise his insurance rate. So the possibilities are endless if surveillance starts to happen. It's very chilling, it's very dystopian, just like how we see in Black Mirror. And like until 2008, we never had a choice. Like, we were born into the system. But after 2008, we really have a choice right now. Like, we really have a choice to opt out of this. And that's what Bitcoin provides.
Maybe you don't need Bitcoin. Maybe Paytm, PayPal, Venmo just serves your needs, or maybe even your bank account takes care of your needs. But just don't write off Bitcoin as an speculation or just an asset you want to invest in. For millions of people, Bitcoin is the escape patch from tyranny, and it's truly freedom money.
And with this, I think we can close this episode. I highly recommend following Alex Gladstein's work. He's been covering a lot about human rights aspect of Bitcoin from Nigeria, Afghanistan, Cuba. So I highly recommend following his work. And yeah, thanks for tuning in. Hey, if you've made it this far, thanks for listening in. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe to the show. You can also send us your feedback to hello@bitcoininfinitypodcast.com or visit our website, bitcoininfinitypodcast.com. We're also on Twitter at Bitcoin8Podcast. That is BITCOIN number 8 podcast. As always, this show is meant for education purposes only and is not financial advice.